Today's book for book club is This Excellent Machine. Stephen Orr is the author. It's a book set in the suburbs in 1984. And a question for the listener is, because when I think of 1984, I think I was 21. And that was a pretty pivotal year for me. So we ask you this morning, what was your pivotal year and why? On 0437 922 720. Stephen is with us. Stephen, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Have you got a pivotal year for us, by the way, before we get into your book?
Well, I guess 1984 was the pivotal year for me because that's why I chose it for the book, because I was finishing year 12 and it's sort of like the end of childhood in a way, isn't it? And then you've got to deal with uni and jobs and reality. So that was a big year for me.
Gee, your book took me back to a lot of memories of things I've sort of forgotten about from the 1980s. There's a lot of detail in there, little things. Can you describe for us life in 1984 from your recollections?
Yeah, I guess so. Well, I don't know. I remember when I started university in 1985, we had some basic old clunkety computers. So the digital age was just in its early stages at that point, you know, and then that changed the world afterwards. So it's a nice dividing line for me. Looking, I remember at uni having the floppy disks and putting them in, and all of this stuff. So that changed things. I remember it. The problem with this book is I didn't want it to become nostalgic, which you always risk when writing this type of book, I guess. So I wanted it to be just the story and the characters, and you know what was going on in the background. But I do remember the suburb it's set in, which is called Glen Eagles in the book, but in reality it's called Hillcrest. I did sort of want to portray that as it was, because it sort of no longer exists. It's just all been knocked down and made into these little mean little townhouses that people live in and never venture out of. And it just seems a shame going down. The street I grew up in was Ramsey Avenue, which is Lanark Avenue in the book. It just seems a real shame, when you look back, and it literally was that cliche of all of us kids, we knew each other, we're in each other's living rooms after school, weekends, riding around on bikes. There's nothing else to do. I mean, that was more out of pure boredom probably than anything. But it was different, and you remember, now that I'm 52, you remember it fondly. But as I said, you don't want to turn it to nostalgia. That's probably the worst thing.
I think of, well, I'll just do that gently for the moment. I think of the Mike Walsh show. I also think of Eddie, the bloke that used to work in the servo that I would go to and have a friendly chat. He was almost like a father figure. You know, he would dispense advice and come out and clean your windscreen. He'd have a real concern for your wagon.
Yeah. Servos were important, weren't they? They were. You know, you really did get a bit of love in the driveway, if you pardon the expression. Well, you know, they lifted your bonnet. Lifted your bonnet and checked your oil you up with 50-50. The character in my book, actually, and he did, his name was John. My mum would pull up in the Holden Kingswood, and he'd check the oil, and he always had a smoke in his hand, which I thought was fantastic at that age that, you know, you work all day doing that and you're just smoking, you just don't care. Yeah, people didn't care so much about anything back then.
But I went to the same servo as well, and it was the servo that my dad passed on to me. So Eddie used to service Dad's car as well, and so he ended up servicing mine. Anyway, let's talk about your book. The book is called This Excellent Machine. As I say, it's set in 1984 in this fictional, well, sort of semi-fictional suburb in Adelaide, Hillcrest in the northeast, I think, in the north.
Yeah, it's northeast. It used to be, when we lived there, it was almost an outer suburb. Now it's almost an inner suburb.
Yeah. Let's talk about Clem Whelan. So he's the protagonist or the central character in this book. Can you tell us about him? Who is Clem?
So Clem, he's fairly highly autobiographical, I guess. I've never really written the whole coming of age book. I've avoided it because that's generally the first thing a writer does is write the coming of age, or you know, disguise their background. But Clem is pretty close to me, I guess, in that instead of doing what his parents tell him, he's sort of off with the fairies, reading books, listening to John Lennon, trying to start a band, just completely wasting time on everything he shouldn't because he's sort of soaking in the world. So he's sitting at his window with a telescope spying on the neighbours, who he finds very interesting. And I mean, the book essentially is the story of each of the neighbours and how it unfolds over the course of it. But, you know, you've got his mum there nagging him to keep studying, and he doesn't. But luckily he gets through year 12 because of, you know, he has this failed lawyer next door that sort of helps him through in the end. But left to him, things wouldn't have ended up as well, I guess.
You also have his grandfather as well, his pop, who is facing the early signs of dementia. What are you exploring about ageing in the book?
Well, I don't know. I don't really have any agenda about ageing. It's just I think, you know, my grandparents, as I was growing up, were very important. You know, they were the rock of the family. They made the decisions. Your parents fell in line with what they decided. And I think we're losing that a little bit. You know, we sort of, these people, we don't worry about, just put them in a nursing home or make sure they're still breathing. We don't seem to be that concerned about the power of old age. So I put Pop, Doug, in the home living with them because there's a missing father, obviously, Clem's father's. That's one of the mysteries in the book, is what happened to his father. So I have Doug living there instead, and Doug's always been a mechanic. And as the book starts, you know, you can see he's starting to forget things, and he gets a big bed sheet and traces the outline of all the components of the car so he doesn't forget what they are and where they go. So he's fighting against what's happening, and Clem is a very perceptive 16-year-old and works this out. And the one thing Doug wanted to do was, you know, he had this map for Lassiter's Reef, which is a sort of, I guess, a sort of bit of a fantasy. But Clem, during the course of the book, Clem works out that whether the map actually was for Lassiter's Reef or had nothing to do with it, was a fake, it didn't really matter. What mattered is, as you're growing older, is the things that meant a lot to you, you know, doing them, finishing them off, and he helps him do that.
My guest this morning on ABC Radio Perth and WA, Stephen Orr, talking about his book, This Excellent Machine. Dialogue's pretty fundamental to this book, and it's very intensive in dialogue, which is evocative. What's that challenge like for you as a writer?
Well, I guess I'm stronger with dialogue than I am with description. And one of the things I've learned, you know, over all the books, the novels I've published, as they languish, you know, in the backs of libraries unread, is that, you know, you don't really need to tell people a lot about a setting or a place for them to get it. You know, this is what I teach. Occasionally when I teach, I sort of say, you can describe a sunset, but we all know what it looks like, so you don't need to. You just need to say it was a sunset. The rest of the baggage comes with the person. So that to me has become less and less. And what's more interesting is humans and how they interact and how dialogue is used, the way we speak to each other, how that's used, you know, like to convince, to get your own way, but also what's more importantly, what's not said, I guess, and how, you know, like in the book, the love Clem has for his pop, for his mum and other people. I mean, no one ever says in the book or ever said when I was growing up, I love you or all this sort of stuff. We skirt around things with the way we say things. I really like that idea that, you know, you can explore relationships and people and psychology through dialogue. And the trend also now with books, it seems to me, is editors just cut dialogue down to the bare basics. And I don't know, I just like a good scene where there's a lot of talking. And, you know, maybe it goes back to, you know, how, when I started off, I was interested in plays a lot more, theatre, and that sort of worked its way through into my novels.
Yeah, well, it's very much in some ways like a play. It's not surprising that you have that background. You said earlier that, you know, you don't want it to be nostalgic, although as you've probably gathered, I don't mind a bit of nostalgia. And for me, this book brought back some pleasant memories. How did you go about recreating some of the details of the 80s? I know you lived through it, but, you know, it's one thing to live through it and have a bit of a memory of it, but it's another to write so clearly about
it. Well, I guess you only use the things that are useful to you in terms of the plot. I don't want to get sort of describe every product that's on the shop shelf, although I remember a lot of them. I want the useful things. For instance, Clem's sister Jen has a hairdressing apprenticeship with a hairdresser called Ferris Trabilsi, who was a big name in Adelaide back in the day. And I really like that. I like the idea of, you know, perms were such an important staple of the hairdresser. They're not anymore. I don't think anyone gets perms, do they, anymore? But apart from OAPs. So
got perms in the 80s.
Oh, Sunday. Absolutely. Yeah. I got one in 1986. I had a sort of mullet perm combination, a la Craig McLaughlin. I still got the photo. I just use what's useful, but stuff that means a lot to me, you know, like the bikes, you know, we all had a dragster in the pre-BMX days, and that's, you know, I still got a picture of that dragster to look back on it fondly. And I don't know, whatever's useful. The mixtape was a big thing, you know, Casey Kasem. You sit and listen to that and take the mixtape off the radio so you've got the latest Tears for Fears or whatever it happened to be. They were good days. It seems to me, you know, when it was harder to get things, they meant more. So those songs, for instance, are very important to my generation. You know, we look back and we look at what's around today and we say, oh, that's rubbish. You know, what are these stupid kids listening to? And we go back and, you know, get out the cold chisel sort of best of and play them. Kids go, that's rubbish. But, you know, like, I don't know, it sort of means more as you get older. But then again, I remember my parents when I was a kid sort of playing Perry Como and me saying, oh, God, this is horrendous. What are you listening to? Or Mantovani's Golden Strings. And I sort of don't want to end up being that person in a way, but maybe it's inevitable that you do become that person. I don't know.
I read a fascinating piece the other day. No, in fact, it was a book looking at the return of analog, and I think it was called The Revenge of Analog, and it was talking about the resurgence of vinyl in the States, and it was saying part of the reason why vinyl has become popular to an extent again was that the physical effort. Not only in purchasing the thing, but physically getting it out of the, you know, the album cover, walking over to the record player, putting it on carefully, putting the needle on. Yeah. And so there was something about that. And so it wasn't automatically available like it can be on streaming.
I still have all my old records and they pop and crackle a bit. I tried to sell them all a while back and I had about 60. And the guy said, I'll give you $200. And I said, you dream. And I left. And I kept them. And I'm glad I did now because you're right. They were the actual physical object and you open it up, the artwork, the lyrics. It seems like a lot of work had gone into that and you could hold it. It's, you know, as with books, I'm a huge reader. You can smell them, hold them. That means something. And I think we've missed that with the whole digital age. Like someone said recently, you know, what's going to happen with all these books online when the electricity goes off? Like they're only a function of the machine they're in or the electricity powering them. Like what's physically left? And maybe that will be important in the future.
The book is called This Excellent Machine. Stephen Orr is the author. Stephen, thank you. Well done on your book.
Thanks for having me.